Cater, Part 1.
Good morning. This is Jane on a very chilly January 22nd, and I'll be reading from the Herald and Review. Let's start with a fun article out of the Robertson Charter School dance team. They are going to perform at an Indiana Pacers game. Lisha Gies is only in sixth grade, but she already knows she wants to be a dance teacher when she grows up. She still gets a bit nervous before a performance, though. Just a little, she said. Laisha is part of the Robertson Charter School dance team, now in its second year. The 12 girls on the team will perform at an Indiana Pacers game on February 24th, thanks to faculty sponsor Jaya Lowry's mother, who put her in touch with the Pacers team. On December 15th, the girls performed during halftime at both the men's and women's games at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville and have performed at Robertson's own home games. Last year, the girls really enjoyed it, and they wanted to learn more about how they could dance in the future, said Heron, the other faculty sponsor. They were set up to go to Millikan University, and they really enjoyed that. They got to set up on center court, and they had mentorships with some of the cheerleaders and stuff at Millikan, and they did that at Eisenhower High School as well. The goal is to broaden their horizons, Heron said. It's to help them realize they can take this on into the future, into high school and college, she said. The opportunity to dance at the Pacers game is especially exciting. The team will dance before the game and will have their own box seats and all the snacks and drinks they want while the game is underway. Heron and Lowry are working on fundraising to get a charter bus to get them there, and donations can be arranged by calling the school at 217-428-7072. It's just the exposure, Lowry said, that there's more to experience than just right here in Decatur. So many different levels and platforms and opportunities are out there. The dance team follows the same guidelines as any other team. The girls have to keep their grades up and exhibit good behavior in order to participate, Heron said. We just have a really good group of girls who are passionate about what they're doing, she said. The girls also mentor younger students at the school and will hold a dance camp where they teach the littles, as the primary age students team is called, some of whom have already shown enough promise to come to rehearsals and performances with the big girls. Two of the littles act as flag bearers during performances, waving purple flags with Wildcat mascots' pictures while the team performs. Choreographer Jayle Lowry, daughter of Jaya Lowry, gives her young dancers as much input as they want on dances. They have a lot of creativity, she said. We just kind of bounce ideas off each other. I ask them what they want to do, and they give me ideas. The youngsters watch a lot of TikTok videos, she said, and they enjoy pop music stars who have background dancers as part of their shows, and they want to dance like that. The dances are a blend of majorette or pom-pom style dances with pop music dances and the girls' own ideas, so it becomes uniquely theirs. I want to be a dancer when I grow up, said Kamaya Scott, a fourth grader. I just love to dance. And since we're on the subject of the Pacers and sports in general, let's look at all-area football, an article entitled Just Having Fun. Not a lot of people knew what to expect from Ike Young in his senior season, which was his first as a varsity starting quarterback, Count Young among them. But in a season where a lot of top area schools replaced quarterbacks, Young emerged as the area's best. He earned All-State honors and helped the Sages to an 11-3 record and a second state title appearance under Coach Coley Welter. He's the Herald and Review All-Area Player of the Year. It was pretty special, Welter said. We just saw it a little bit in 7-on-7s. You saw that there were times when even if plays broke down, Ike had the confidence that Carter Foran would get open. Carter had the confidence that Ike would get him the ball. It's pretty neat when you see a connection like that. Foran broke multiple school records with his 1,854 receiving yards, while Young finished the season with 3,276 passing yards, 1,108 rushing yards, and 49 total touchdowns. That duo was unstoppable this fall. I think they very much exceeded our expectations, Welter said. Young had played quarterback in middle school, but moved to running back in his junior year to get on the field. After the quarterback job opened up, Young moved back over after some work in the off season. Coming from running back is different. You have a lot more responsibilities. Just with our whole playbook and just going over reps and putting the work in the off season, it really determined how our season went. So I think dedication and hard work in the off season is really important. In college, Young will be a pitcher at Illinois. He'd always viewed his future on the baseball field, but still stuck with football to play with friends and be part of the excitement of playing for a top football program. Football wasn't really my priority or really a thought in that process of getting older going to play, Young said. But as I grew up, I kind of filled in my athleticism. I saw my potential in football, but I also saw my potential in baseball. So I kind of bounced back between those two. His arm talent as a pitcher translated seamlessly to the football field. His coaches would tell him to use his velocity if he was late on a read. And his knowledge of the playbook from having varsity experience meant that it didn't happen too often. His ability to get Foran and other offensive weapons the ball downfield made the Monticello offense a tough matchup in the postseason. He's smooth. He's got a quick release, Welter said. But what I miss about him that sort of separates him from other quarterbacks is he'll put the ball in situations where the receiver's not necessarily wide open, but he'll kind of throw them up to a place where they are open, even though it doesn't look that way. Young's Monticello curtain call will be a senior baseball season where he'll be one of the top area pitchers before suiting up in the orange and blue, but he'll always cherish his final football season. I never thought I'd be here in this position in football, because baseball's always been my priority, Young said. But just getting here, I'm so proud of this team and what we've accomplished. And in another football item, Sullivan's Bertetto Coach of the Year. Sullivan Ocal Valley's John Bertetto didn't have a varsity roster in 2021. But turned that freshman class into one that would win all of its regular season games in 2024 as seniors. He built an impressive offense around Aaron Freiman and Cooper Christensen, while DeMarcus Moore and others led the way for physical defense. Sullivan broke a 37-game losing streak in 2022 before going 19-3 the past 2 years. Coley Welter got the Sages back to the state title game for another impressive season, while Ryan Jefferson led another successful season at Arthur Lovington Atwood Hammond to give Bertetto some tough competition. Okay, before we move to some more national news, let's look at the local obituaries. Let's start with Gerald Huck of Decatur, Illinois. Gerald Huck died on January 14th in Decatur at the age of 92. Visitation for Gerald Huck will be held from 10 to 11:30 a.m. on Saturday, January 25th, at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home in Decatur. Funeral service will immediately follow at 11:30 at the same location, and burial will be in Graceland Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials honoring Gerald may be made to St. Teresa High School, 2710 North Water Street in Decatur, 62526. Condolences and memories may be shared with the family in care of Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Homes. Next, Roger E. Lawyer, born in September 1947 and died on January 18, 2025. Roger E. Lawyer, age 77, of Oakley, Illinois, passed away on Saturday, January 18th, at Springfield Memorial Hospital in Springfield, Illinois. A funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, January 22nd, that's today, at Cerro Gordo United Methodist Church in Cerro Gordo. Visitation will take place from 4 to 8 on Tuesday, all right, that was yesterday. Interment will follow the funeral service at Cerro Gordo Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be directed to the Lawyer family in care of Amy Kerr, K-E-R-R. Family and friends are invited to share condolences and memories at the Brintlinger and Earl Funeral Home, 2827 North Oakland Avenue in Decatur. You can phone them at 217-875-1283. Next, Kenneth Cribbs. Kenneth Dale Kenny Cribbs, age 73, of Decatur, died Friday, January 17th, 2025, in his residence with his family by his side. A family-led celebration of life will be held Saturday, January 25th, at Lampstand Church Chapel, that's in Decatur, 655 Airport Road in Decatur, beginning at 1 p.m. Pastor Kirk Henneberry will be officiating. Memorials, if desired, may be made to the American Kidney Foundation. Tanzias Logan Funeral Service and Care is assisting with those arrangements. Next, Kevin Ray. Kevin D. Ray was born on February 17, 1949, in South Bend, Indiana. On January 16, 2025, with his family by his side, Kevin went home to be with his Lord and Savior. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. on Thursday, January 23rd, in the First Christian Church of Shelbyville, with Reverend Tina Miller, Dr. Wayne Kent, and Dr. Rick Grace officiating. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, January 22nd, in Howe and Yoki Funeral Home in Shelbyville, Illinois. The burial will be in Glenwood Cemetery, Shelbyville, with flag presentation by the Shelby County Honor Guard. Memorials in Kevin's honor may be made to the First Christian Church of Shelbyville or Disciple Heritage Fellowship, care of First Christian Church, 3350 North MacArthur Road in Decatur, 62526. And finally, John Kenneth Grissom. John Kenneth Grissom, age 94, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away at 10:57 p.m. on Thursday in Decatur. A funeral service will be held at 12 p.m. on Wednesday, that's today, at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home, with visitation from 11 until service time. The burial will be in Mount Gilead Cemetery. Condolences and memories may be shared with the family in care of Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Homes. And here's a general health-related article with the headline, Surprise Finding Sheds Light on What Causes Huntington's Disease, a Devastating, Fatal Brain Disorder. Scientists are unraveling the mystery of what triggers Huntington's disease, a devastating and fatal hereditary disorder that strikes in the prime of life, causing nerve cells in parts of the brain to break down and die. The genetic mutation linked to Huntington's has long been known, but scientists haven't understood how people could have the mutation from birth but not develop any problems until later in life. New research shows that the mutation is, surprisingly, harmless for decades. But it quietly grows into a larger mutation until it eventually crosses a threshold, generates toxic proteins, and kills the cells it has expanded in. The conundrum in our field has been, why do you have a genetic disorder that manifests later in life if the gene is present at conception? Said Dr. Mark Meller, who directs the Institute for Brain Disorders and Neural Regeneration at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and was not involved in the research. He called the research a landmark study and said, quote, it addresses a lot of the issues that have plagued the field for a long time. The brain cell death eventually leads to problems with movement, thinking, and behavior. Huntington's symptoms, which include involuntary movement, unsteady gait, personality changes, and impaired judgment, typically begin between the ages of 30 and 50, gradually worsening over 10 to 25 years. Scientists at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, McLean Hospital in Massachusetts, and Harvard Medical School studied brain tissue donated by 53 people with Huntington's and 50 without it, analyzing 500,000 cells. They focused on the Huntington's mutation, which involves a stretch of DNA in a particular gene where a three-letter sequence, CAG, is repeated at least 40 times. In people without the disease, this sequence is repeated just 15 to 35 times. They discovered that DNA tracts with 40 or more such repeats expand over time until they are hundreds of CAGs long. Once CAGs reach a threshold of about 150, certain types of neurons sicken and die. The findings were really surprising, even to us, said Steve McCarroll, a Broad member and co-senior author of the study, which was published this month in the journal Cell, C-E-L-L. The study was partly funded by the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, an organization that also supports the Associated Press Health and Science Department. The research team estimated that repeat tracts grow slowly during the first two decades of life. Then the rate accelerates dramatically when they reach about 80 CAGs. The longer the repeats, the earlier in life the onset will happen, said neuroscience researcher Sabina Beretta, one of the study's senior authors. Researchers acknowledge that some scientists were initially skeptical when the results were shared at conferences, since previous work found that repeat expansions in the range of 30 to 100 CAGs were necessary but not sufficient to cause Huntington's. McCarroll agreed that 100 or fewer CAGs are not sufficient to trigger the disease, but said his study found that expansions with at least 150 CAGs are. Researchers hope their findings can help scientists come up with ways to delay or prevent the incurable condition, which afflicts about 41,000 Americans and is now treated with medications to manage the symptoms. Recently, experimental drugs designed to lower levels of protein produced by the mutated Huntington's gene struggled in trials. New findings suggest that's because few cells have the toxic version of the protein at any given time. Slowing or stopping the expansion of DNA, repeats may be a better way to target the disease, researchers said. Though there are no guarantees this would stave off Huntington's, McCarroll said many companies are starting or expanding programs to try to do this. And here's an article from the Business World. Companies ditching DEI. Facebook and Instagram parent company Meta Platforms Incorporated joins a growing list of companies that are pulling back on diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. Like others before it, the social media giant cited a U.S. Supreme Court decision in July 2023 that outlawed affirmative action in college admissions. Conservative activists have gone after companies, both in the courts and on social media, seeking to set a similar precedent in the working world. They've been targeting workplace initiatives such as diversity programs and hiring practices that prioritize historically marginalized groups and have widened their objections to include programs focused on gender identity and sexual orientation. DEI policies typically are intended as a counterweight to discriminatory practices. Critics argue that education, government, and business programs that single out participants based on factors such as race, gender, and sexual orientation are unfair, and the same opportunities should be afforded to everyone. Joel Kaplan, Meta's freshly appointed global policy chief, told Fox News Digital, the move will ensure that the company is building teams with the most talented people instead of making hiring decisions based on protected characteristics. Here's a look at some of the other companies that have retreated from DEI. McDonald's. 4 years after launching a push for more diversity in its ranks, McDonald's said on January 6th, that it will retire specific goals for achieving diversity at senior leadership levels. It also intends to end a program that encourages its suppliers to develop diversity training and to increase the number of minority group members represented within their own leadership ranks. McDonald's said it will also pause so-called external surveys. The burger giant didn't elaborate, but several other companies, including Lowe's, Ford Motor Company, suspended their participation in an annual survey by the Human Rights Campaign that measures workplace inclusion for LGBTQ+ employees. Walmart, the world's largest retail, confirmed in November it would not renew a 5-year commitment for an equity racial center set up in 2020 after the police killing of George Floyd, and that it would stop participating in the Human Rights Campaign's annual benchmark index measuring workplace inclusion for LGBTQ+ employees. Walmart also said it will better monitor its third-party marketplace to make sure items sold there do not include products aimed at LGBTQ+ minors, including chest binders intended for transgender youth. Additionally, the company will no longer consider race and gender as a litmus test to improve diversity when it offers supplier contracts, and it won't gather demographic data when determining financing eligibility for those grants. Ford. CEO Jim Farley sent a memo to the automaker's employees in August outlining changes to the company's DEI policies, including a decision to stop taking part in HRC's Corporate Equality Index. Ford, he wrote, looked at its policies for a year. The company doesn't use hiring quotas or tie compensation to specific diversity goals, but remained committed to fostering a safe and inclusive workplace, Farley said. We will continue to put our effort and resources into taking care of our customers, our team, our communities, versus publicly commenting on the many polarizing issues of the day. Lowe's. In August, Lowe's executive leadership and the company began reviewing its programs following the Supreme Court's affirmative action ruling and decided to combine its employee resource groups into one umbrella organization. Previously, the company had individual groups representing diverse sections of our associate population. The retailer also will no longer participate in the HRC index and will stop sponsoring and participating in events such as festivals and parades that are outside of its business areas. John Deere. The farm equipment maker said in July it will no longer sponsor social or cultural awareness events, and that it would audit all training materials to ensure the absence of socially motivated messages in compliance with federal and local laws. The Moline, Illinois-based John Deere added that the existence of diversity quotas and pronoun identification never were and are not company policy. However, it noted that it would still continue to track and advance the diversity of the company. Tractor Supply. The rural retailer in June said it would end an array of corporate diversity and climate efforts. Tractor Supply said it would eliminate all of its DEI roles while retiring current DEI roles. The company added it would stop sponsoring non-business activities such as pride festivals or voting campaigns and no longer submit data to the HRC index. The Brentwood, Tennessee-based company, which sells products ranging from farming equipment to pet supplies, also said it would withdraw from its carbon emission goals to instead focus on our land and water conservation efforts. The National Black Farmers Association called on Tractor Supply's president and CEO to step down shortly after the company's announcement. And finally, an article regarding immigration. Migrants are stranded when thousands of appointments to enter the U.S. are canceled as Trump takes office. They came from Haiti, Venezuela, and around the world, pulling small rolling suitcases crammed with clothing and stuffed animals to occupy their children. They clutched cell phones, showing that after months of waiting, they had their appointments, finally, to legally enter the United States. Outside a series of North Mexico border crossings, where mazes of concrete barriers and thick fencing eventually spill into the United States, hope and excitement evaporated into despair and disbelief moments after President Donald Trump took office. U.S. Customs and Border Protection announced Monday that the CBP One app that worked as recently as that same morning would no longer be used to admit migrants after facilitating entry for almost 1 million people since January 2023. Tens of thousands of appointments that were scheduled into February were canceled, applicants were told. That was it. There was no way to appeal and no one to talk to. In Tijuana, where 400 people were admitted daily on the app at the border crossing with San Diego, Maria Mercado had to work up the courage to check her phone. Tears ran down her cheeks after she finally looked. Her family's appointment for 1 p.m., 4 hours too late. "We don't know what we are going to do," she said, standing with her family within view of the United States. She left Colombia decades ago after it was overrun by drug cartel violence, heading for Ecuador. When cartels besieged her new homeland, the family fled again in June, this time to Mexico, hoping to reach the U.S. "I'm not asking the world for anything, only God. I'm asking God to please let us get in," she said. Immigrants around her hugged or cried quietly. Many stared ahead blankly, not knowing what to do. A nearby sign urged people to get the CBP One app. "This will facilitate your processing," it said. CBP One was widely popular, especially with Venezuelans, Cubans, Haitians, and Mexicans. Now they were stranded at the U.S. border or deeper in Mexico. Jairo Polo, 38, tried getting an appointment for 6 months from Mexico City before snagging one Wednesday in Matamoros, across from Brownsville, Texas. The Cuban man flew Monday from Mexico's capital to learn at the Matamoros-Brownsville border crossing that his appointment had been canceled. "Imagine how we feel," he said dejectedly. "People with morning appointments got through on schedule, Andrem Roman, a 28-year-old Venezuelan, was in the last group to cross the border with the CBP-1 in Ciudad Juarez, across from El Paso, Texas. "We are a little safer now because we are here," he said just before handing over his documents to U.S. authorities, "but you still don't know what's going to happen," he said.